Okay, we are now just about ready to go. So, Tom, you're just going to present, you're going to talk about what you're going to talk about, right?
Basically, yep.
A recursive presentation. Okay.
I just use the arrow keys to switch back and forth? Or?
Yeah, the arrow keys will work fine. There's a page up and page down here.
Okay. Right, okay. So I apologize to that you have to listen to a talk so late at night in this beautiful surroundings. So, well, first of all, thanks, Jack, for having me here and give this talk to you. So this is basically a short summary of a talk I gave at the Inactive Interfaces Conference in France end of last year. And it's some work that I've been doing with a colleague of mine, Adam Spears, who's at the University of Bristol. So, just an overview of the structure of the talk. So I'm briefly going to mention some philosophical motivations that got us interested in this. Then some design requirements and specifications of the Inactive Torch, and some initial experiments that we've been doing, and some of the future projects that we're involved in. So I probably don't need to say much about Inactive Cognitive Science, and if we do, then I guess that's something that I can talk about later on in the week. But one of the important claims is that it says perception consists in perceptually guided action. And one of the sources of evidence that it uses to make this claim are sensory substitution devices. So these are devices that were first devised by Bajirita and his colleagues in the late 1960s. And you're probably familiar with most of you are probably familiar with this. They allowed blind subjects to do and engage a lot of tasks that normally require vision. But what really caught the attention of the Inactive theorists was that it also spontaneously gave rise to reports of spatial modes of perceptual awareness. So people were reporting that they could see objects in space even though they're normally blind. So one of the examples of this is Bajirita saying in his original Nature paper, saying that our subjects spontaneously report the external localization of stimuli, and that sensory information seems to come in front of the camera rather than from the vibrotectors on their back. So these are the kind of descriptions that you can find in the literature, and there are quite a lot of them. But the problem that happened was that nobody could really agree on what this means in terms of the perception modality. Is it something like touch or vision, or maybe perhaps even an entirely new perception modality? So the kind of evidence that people were using to make heavily on this question of what it is like to use one of these devices come basically from two kinds. So on the one hand, we have Bajirita's and other people's descriptions of the abilities of the subjects of what they can do. And on the other hand, we have summaries of their verbal reports. But notice that both of these are actually third-person sources of data.
What?
Yeah?
The second one, I don't understand why the second one is third-person.
Well, second-person? Well, because it's not Bajirita saying that I think this. It's someone else saying it.
But if he did, and you told us about it, it would suddenly become second person again, because you wouldn't be saying it, you would be reporting Bajirita talking about it.
Well, the main point is that he never talks about his own experience.
But the subjects talked about their own experience. Why isn't that good enough for it to be first person?
Because they're not writing the paper.
Yeah, okay, never mind.
I mean, it's perfectly standard to talk about verbal reports and the old behaviorist days.
Sure.
That's with a third person view of an experience with a verbal report. And you're just using the standard.
There will never be first person approaches about it. Okay.
Well, the first person would be for you actually to use the device. So.
Yeah, fine. We can
discuss this. All right. Okay. So based on these two sources of evidence, we have conflicting reports. So Noe, for example, says it is reasonable to admit that the resulting experiences are, if not fully visual, then vision-like to some extent. Block says there is doubt as to whether the phenomenology of TVSS is exclusively visual, and that perhaps TVSS is a case of spatial perception via tactile sensation. And finally, Prince says, my best guess is that prosthetic vision devices simply allow subjects to make automatic inferences about where objects are located in space as a result of tactile information. And you can find other variations of this as well. So what I would say is that it's quite doubtful whether they would ever come to an agreement, in particular because none of them have actually ever tried using TVSS themselves. And that's the reason why I say that we should use a first-person approach. Now, the problem is that, and as I'm sure we're going to discuss more in this workshop here, it's not easy to set up this kind of phenomenological pragmatics. But in the case of the sensor substitution devices, it's even more difficult, but because Bahi research devices are not generally available to the research community, and even those that are quite expensive, they require a lot of training, and so they're quite impractical. So what we really want is something that is, you know, effortlessly replicated, so any lab can get one of their own. They're cheap, non-intrusive, simple to learn, handle, and study, but of course at the same time they're still supposed to generate some interesting results, similar to the ones that the Bahirita device did. So our proposal was that the inactive torch fills those requirements. So the torch itself is based on an earlier device designed by Adam Spears called the haptic torch, which he designed as a part of his degree for blind navigation. And his motivation for designing this was that there are certain limitations to the traditional cane, that it misses certain objects, it requires direct physical contact, and therefore the perception is limited. Actually, coming from the inactive point of view now, we can say that the reason that it's limited is because of the direct physical contact. So if you have a cane, and if you look at them, they usually keep it quite close to their body, because, you know, you don't want to hit people, you don't want to hit cars and other objects. But, you know, if the inactive point of view is right, then actually you should be exploring as wildly as possible in order to get the best perceptual resolution of your environment. So, in any case, that was the original motivation. And there were some other ways of trying to solve this. These are some of the kind of cognitivist traditional approaches where you try to scan the whole environment and represent everything as a model and then kind of use that as a basis for helping the blind person to navigate, but as you can see, a lot of these were just ridiculously impractical. So this was the device. It was just based on one single ultrasonic sensor and one single tactile actuator. And so even though it had only one channel of stimulation, actually that was quite sufficient to navigate your environment, because just like we have a kind of a stable visual field in our experience, what our eyes do is actually saccade around all the time. So basically, this is what the inactive torch does too. You just use it to saccade around the environment to points of interest. At least that's the idea. So this is the original haptic torch. It had a kind of turning device where you put your thumb on, and then depending on the distance to objects, this sensation underneath your thumb would indicate to you how far things are that you're pointing at. And then we started trying this out with some of our friends. So we basically put them in a field and said, find the lamppost. And you can imagine with a cane, this would be almost impossible. You would just have to have random search around you. Well, maybe you can use something like echolocation if you're well trained. But with the torch, it actually becomes quite a salient object, even though it's quite thin. So even after, this is only after minutes of training, he is able to find the object quite quickly.
Try sweeping the torch around a little bit.
And this is actually a blind subject who tried out the original device, and same task.
Excellent.
And you can see that he himself is surprised how easy that was. He just kind of walks up to it and finds it right away. So for the inactive torch, so this was done a few years ago. Then this last summer, I basically, when I become more and more interested in active perception, I got back together with my friend and said, look, we need to build another one of these devices to study perception. And this is what turned into the inactive torch. So we added a few things to interface it with computers, get data off it, added a few extra outputs, such as vibrotactile, so it vibrates in relation to how far things are. And the data capture works quite nicely. So down here we have a graph of where we were sweeping the torch, and these are things that are close, these are further away, close, further away. So the thing that it was scanning was actually this room. So even the side bits of the window are quite actually represented. But even if it be this as it may, actually, you know, a lot of people will say that, okay, you know, oh, there was a glitch there, or maybe there was a little bit of delay or a little bit of noise, and all of those are true. I mean, this thing was, it's just like the first prototype that we built. Actually, Adam built it in his bedroom, basically. So, but at the same time, if an active approach is what they say is true, then that's okay, because, you know, the more you explore, you cancel out the noise, actually. So if you sweep across something and something buzzes, but on the way back it doesn't buzz at the same spot, then basically once you've practiced a little bit, you know, that doesn't even arise in, you know, as a significant in your experience. So even though it's very crude, you know, the action cancels out the noise and constitutes perception anyway. Then we had a couple of volunteers trying out the device, you know, just a little obstacle course to pick up something on the back, and as a reward they got a box of donuts, and we asked them for some comments. So these are some initial results, and guy said the vibration was initially more intuitive, and it stopped feeling like vibration, more like space. Well, so that was at least hopeful initial results, that there was something to be explored there. So true to our approach, I said, okay, well, fine, then I'll have to use the device, and I basically locked myself away for a weekend and just constantly played around with it, you know, doing different techniques and different, you know, open doors, closed doors, finding around my way in my room. And after a while, I noticed that I wasn't paying so much attention anymore to the stimulus in your hand, because that's what you initially do. You're very conscious about what's going on in your hand, and you deduce from that distances. But soon enough, that kind of becomes less significant, and you start noticing invariances. So, for example, when I had a corner or something like this in my room, it becomes quite clear that there's an increase in stimulus here and then a decrease. And when you sweep around like that, and that becomes a very concrete sensory motor profile of a corner. So when I was doing like this, and I turned around, and when I did, I was like, oh, and, you know, I noticed this. I opened my eyes and I was like, oh yeah, actually my room has another corner like that on the other side, and I didn't even think about it before, but it was very clear in my experience that I was having the same experience as the other corner. And then finally, after a couple of hours of training, what happened was that when I was sweeping across objects, actually I started feeling resistance in my wrist. And of course, my wrist is moving freely, but it just felt like there was some sort of viscous, you know, resistance that I was passing through with the device. So, and that was only after a few hours. So I imagine that if you still spend some more time with it, then who knows what kind of experience we could get with it. I just find that, you know, in some sense, your hand, which you move in order to feel texture like this on a microscopic scale, perhaps what we're just doing is, you know, putting a telescope on there and just kind of feeling the texture of the world by brushing around like that. But of course, more phenomenological research is clearly needed. And hopefully maybe we can do some of that here with you trying it out. So some of the future projects that we want to do, we just wanted to use it as a device to get people, as an incentive for people to get together and try to describe their experiences and try to intersubjectively validate them and see if we can find some invariances, some structures, that, you know, what kind of problems do we run into doing that kind of project. And then, of course, the other thing is that because it's a simple technology, we can start playing around with the sensory motor profile of the device and seeing, does that change the experience in any lawful manner? So, for example, you know, if I change the transfer function in there to make it steeper or less steep, or, you know, put in a sigmoid transfer function between distance and stimulation, does that somehow change your experience of the world as you're interacting with it? That's a nice possibility of using it. Then the other thing is that we got in contact with a group of blind artists in the UK. They're called Extant, and they're at the moment writing different proposals for a blind theatre commission where they want to immerse the audience into some sort of performance piece using the device as well. So hopefully we'll get some feedback through that way as well. And of course, another interesting aspect here is that the battery Vita device is never really picked up in the blind community. And battery Vita always says the reason was that the technology was didn't have enough resolution or was still too bulky and so on. And those are probably all good reasons. But what people in Compiègne have said is that actually what the problem was is that meaningful perception is something that is constituted in a social way. And the reason that people didn't really use the devices was because they didn't feel any meaning from the perceptions that they got with it. So people were looking at images of their wife or a student with some pictures of a naked lady and so on. But for them, the reaction was completely cold. I mean, they could objectively make out what it was, but there was no feeling attached to it. So whereas Buffy Rita says that's the problem because there's not enough resolution, the other option would be to say, no, it's because they weren't actually constituting those perceptions in a community of people that share similar experiences and use the device. So with the blind artists, we actually have a chance to probably build several of these devices and have people interact and then see, does that change the experience of using them? Can we actually notice a different phenomenology in a social context? So finally, it was just a very pragmatic tool of getting people to start thinking about how to describe their experiences, making it concrete of what the inactive approach is about. So I can say, why is action important for perception? Well, here, try this device. So it's a very simple and pragmatic way of going about things. And we were looking for more funding when I was giving this presentation last, but luckily actually Sussex has given us a small research grant, and so we're now in the next phase of building several of these devices, which are then also going to be used in master's classes and other university. And we're setting up a couple of experiments. Maybe just briefly mention them in case you have any ideas or suggestions of other things that we might want to try. One of them is basically to say that the feedback that you get from the device is binary. Either there is something or there is not. And then if you're allowed to move your hand completely freely, what you can do is sense the distance anyway, because you can triangle it basically through your actions. But what happens if we restrain your freedom so that you can only move your arm, let's say, like this, you can still point to where it is, let's say, you know, it's over there, but you lose the sense of distance. So actually your body and the freedom that you have with your body, you know, changes the kind of dimensionality of the space around you. And that's, you know, it's a very simple experiment that we can replicate with this device. And the other thing that we want to do is basically just have simple shapes, let's say a big oval shape, and ask people to recognize it, and a big square, and ask people to recognize it. And once they get very proficient at doing that, just say, okay, here's another trial. And unbeknownst to them, just play back a recording of the stimulus that they had in a previous successful trial, and then see, can they still make sense of the stimulus? Because if the theory that action is necessary for perception is right, then they shouldn't be able to make sense of that stimulus, even though it actually has exactly the same information in it than the one that they previously had experience. So, you know, it's just trying to show very simply again that, you know, action is very important for perception. So these are the two experiments that we have. And we set up a little blog as well for all the different reports and conferences and things that are going on with it. So that's it. So for this conference, I just brought it along. So this is the first prototype. We still haven't finished building the next generation with the new funding, but I don't know, I'll basically have it around here, I guess, so maybe in breaks, something like that, between talks. People just want to have a go and try to feel their way around. We found a little nice area next to the dinner place where there's some free space with some open doors and things like that, so it's very easy there to get a sense of the different settings of the device. And that's it.
Maybe could we have an orientation session at some point where you could, you know, like maybe at a break tomorrow or something, where you could show us?
Yeah, sure.
And demonstrate it. So we'll just look for a time tomorrow morning and then figure out how it can be available for people if we have a sign up or something like that. So,
Okay, right. Thanks.
Great. Thanks.
Tom, about your second experiment, I'm not sure. What would you learn different from, say, let's say you gave people goggles with video cameras on each eye. So they're seeing the output of the video camera coming into each eye. And then you just, so they look around, they can see stuff. And then you, instead of one time, you don't actually have what's currently coming in from the camera. You just play them recording of what came into the camera on a previous encounter.
Right.
I mean, I don't think anybody would think that that would make any sense. That if before you cut it down to the left and you cut it up to the right, and now you're doing some different movements, but you're getting exactly the same things that you saw before when you did cut. I think everybody would. I mean,
I think
is there anybody who thinks that the experience would be the same?
Not that the experience would be the same, but in the video case, you would still see, okay, there's a picture there, there's a cover there, right?
This kind of so I guess that's all I needed to hear. Because I would expect that if the stuff you're getting in through your eye doesn't match where your eye is going, then it'll be you won't be able to make any sense of your visual experience. So if when you look down into the left, you no longer see that red flower there, but you see that light. When I move my eye down to the left, because I was just playing back what I saw last time I used these cameras, and it'll just be a mess. It'll just be incoherent. You won't see a visual, stable, static visual scene.
I guess it depends on the setup, but I mean, otherwise, how different is a TV? I mean, you know, like if the camera's moving and showing different scenes of a room, let's say, of course your eyes are all fixed on the TV.
My setup is just, I have a camera over this, that's the camera where this eye is, and the camera this eye. So I don't actually see what's in front of me. I see what the camera sees.
Well, just like the reverse goggle experiment. So.
No. Okay, I have a camera coming into this eye, a camera coming into this eye. I see, it's just like you're holding up your digital camera in front of your eye.
Yeah.
Okay? So you're seeing what's in front of you, only it goes through a digital camera first. And then, without telling subjects, I swap it so that instead of seeing what's currently in front of their, you know, their eyes, they see what they saw last time they used this camera. And last time that they got those inputs, they did have a visual experience that made sense. Because when they looked down into the left, they saw the red flower there. And when they looked up into the right, they saw the light. But now when I look straight ahead and don't move my eye, I see a red flower and I see a light right after it. Or if I move my eye up into the left, I see what I saw last time moving down. It'll be an incoherent just...
Well, you already said flower and light. I mean, all I'm saying is with this device, you wouldn't even have an object per se.
I didn't mean to say... Okay, that's not important. Yeah. Red patch... White patch or whatever, it doesn't matter.
If it does,
something like this happens with camcorders, I think, because when you look through the world, looked at on the screen of a camcorder, you get confused as to whether you're actually looking at where the thing's pointing in real time, whether you're actually playing back at the previous video of the same scene. And you get a kind of disorientation.
I'm agreeing with Ryan, because if I look down and I see the red, and I look down and I see the light, then I'm likely to be confused about that and think, well, that was strange, so I'm going to look back at it. And so there, I'm going to get some saccades that go because I'm interested in there. But that kind of repeated at the same thing isn't going to be replayed in the either in the visual or in the haptic sense, it doesn't seem to me.
So you probably realized pretty quickly that
Something
was wrong.
Really wacky here.
Something was, you'd say, wait, this isn't right.
Right.
I'm just saying, it's a great idea for experiment. I just don't think I think it's confusing things to take that good experimental idea which establishes the inactivist point, and then add on to it this extra complication of the inactive torch, which is this device that we don't understand very well yet. In other words, you could take that good idea for an experiment and do it with stuff that we already understand.
It's showing that even for a really simple sense. And plus, I mean, I don't know how complicated it would be to set up what you're talking about. So here, and in fact, the interesting thing is here you can just experientially, you know, do that to people and say, right here, explore the room. And then they're like, oh yeah, you know, okay, here's the door, I find it. And then you say, okay, explore this room. And they're like, I don't know, I can't do it. And then it's like, that's because there was no relationship between your action and what you were sensing. It's a very pragmatic way of showing people the necessity of action in what they're perceiving.
Yeah.
Okay, so we want to end up pretty quickly, so let me take the next 10 minutes to introduce what I have in mind, okay? I'm going to ask you right away to do something, almost right away. first, right away. Just take a moment to feel what you're feeling. Just be aware of what's going on in the body. And I mean that in the loosest possible sense. But I won't try to say any more, I guess. Whatever that means to you, just take a moment. Okay, now I want to ask you a question. And the wording here is it's hard to get the wording just right, so maybe we'll have to together work on it. The question is this. When you have experiences, there is a central point, you might say, from which the experience takes place. We have the sense, and you can question this theoretically, but I'm talking in very common sense terms now. We have the sense that we observe our experience from a certain vantage point. My question is, and I don't want to emphasize the word observe too much because that immediately throws you into the visual, but just in general, for any kind of experience you may have, where do you conceive of yourself to be located when you're having an experience? It might be a visual experience, but it might not. If you say there is a center of gravity, although that's not quite the right word, for the experience, where do you conceive of yourself to be located? What is the center of your experience? Any experience. You could try it right now, or give the theoretical answer. That's all right. I don't care too much. So where would you say, where are you located most, let's say most of the time, right now or most of the time?
Say, yeah.
Right, kind of between the eyes or above the forehead, in this area. Okay. Anybody else?
You asked the question in two different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the experience located? And you said, where's the self located? They're not the same questions.
No, I really mean more, where is your sense of yourself as the one who is experienced?
Okay.
I mean, I think that fluctuates. I mean, mm-hmm. So I don't know that there's a determinate answer to
the question. Yeah, the answer may not always be the same, but I am asking.
And it may not be there may not even, you know, I mean it may be the sort of question which really can't be answered.
Because
any answer given would be inadequate or be misleading in some way.
So you think it's not necessarily a good description of experience to say that there is a point, a kind of a central point from which we experience? That's just a wrong way to put the issue.
Possibly. I don't know. I want to.
I think I agree with Steve on that one.
I'm not sure that's what I really want to say, but I'm. Yeah, but it may be that that's what I would. I would shy away. I might want to shy away from committing myself to actually saying this is the location of the point from which the experience.
So when you try right now, if you just look out at, you know, if you look across the room at Ron, you don't want to. Do you want to shy away from giving an answer to that question? Is there a place?
I think it's more of a relation rather than a point.
Uh-huh.
So. I don't think any relation has a location.
It's more of a what side, isn't it?
Relation?
Ah.
Like it's a relation of thing.
Here's a common sense, I mean, not just common sense, but here's one answer that it tries to get a little more specific than it's just saying, oh, we can't say. And it's not a point, it's just to say, it's like to, maybe this is ripping off some of Max's ideas, but just say, well, I feel located in the area where, okay, some of my sensations are located. Like taking Max's point, my sensation of you is located. You see that far away. But forget those. We're talking about where I am. That's where you are.
That's right.
So let's identify me with the set of possible experiences that I can have, like bodily experiences. Mm-hmm. That's one idea. I know not everybody agrees that they're their body, but if there's one intuitive idea that you are your body, So I could just say, well, the part of the location, it isn't a point, but it's the set of all the places in space that I can have bodily experiences at.
Mm-hmm.
So here. So this is where I am. I'm at the place, there's parts in space right now where I can have bodily experiences. I can't have a bodily experience over there, so I'm not located over there. I can't have a bodily experience in Paris right now, so I'm not in Paris. But I feel located in this region because this is the area where I can have.
Mm-hmm.
And so I might shrink if you get anesthetized. You know, maybe there isn't one answer. You know, it varies from context to context.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe right now, in this context of you having us think about our bodily sensations, which is what you did before,
mm-hmm.
I'd say, okay, I feel, in this context, I feel located where in those parts of space where I can have sensations.
But can you make it more precise? And let me try to give you an example. Suppose I ask you to feel your foot. Is your experience centered in your foot, or do you experience it from somewhere else within the general range of your body, or somewhere else?
It's in my foot. The experience is located.
Somebody stands on my foot and says, where do I feel the pain? I'd say I feel it in the foot.
Right.
But that wasn't the question you asked.
Right.
You're really asking the observer question.
I'm asking the observer question.
And to me, I was just agreeing with you. And my subjective experience is that because I'm visually dominant,
mm-hmm.
is from the point of reference for my sight. And that's, it's not really a big issue as far as I know. In nearly all of philosophy of mind would accept that conscious experience is perspectival.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they mean. That we all view all there is to view from a perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And the natural perspective is exactly the one that you pick.
Somewhere in this region.
That's mm-hmm. the first subjective appearance of where we, you know, whether it's right,
mm-hmm.
it's only an appearance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the second bit. That because all appearances are just appearances.
Right. I'm not asking for the truth.
No. Nevertheless, that's how it appears. So.
Right.
Yeah, I would agree.
The trouble is that when you ask the question, you then there's a sort of shift in attention. If I'm sort of talking to you,
mm-hmm.
I feel projected, you know, out there. So if you like, I feel that my experience is sort of coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, if we're having a very, you know, sort of involved discussion,
mm-hmm.
Maybe our experience is somehow there, you know, a shared thing.
Mm-hmm.
But if you ask me, so where is the you that's, where are you located?
Mm-hmm.
Then I might suddenly shift my perspective back inside me.
Mm-hmm.
But then I'm no longer talking about, you know, the experience as it was experienced at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I've gone back into, I've changed the subject to silver.
Mm-hmm.
The question
mm-hmm.
may change the answer.
Yeah.
But there's still always a place where you experience your me as being. Isn't it a bit disingenuous to say that if you're focusing on your foot, when somebody asks you to focus on or concentrate on sensations, your consciousness hasn't all shot to your foot. That your foot is then the object of your consciousness. You're not, your foot is not your conscious state at that point in time. Your consciousness is somewhere here, and you feel the energy of your consciousness is here. I can't see that it can be in your foot.
The pain.
That's where the experience is, but you experience it.
But that's what we think. We're thinking of pain as a conscious experience. Pain itself is a conscious experience.
Oh, right, okay.
And so, I disagree with Max. I don't think, for me, I'm experiencing, I'm not aware of the pain in my foot from here.
Mm-hmm. Really?
I'm aware of the pain in my foot.
That's not what I said. That's not the question you asked.
Right.
I reflect on my pains, I don't feel like I'm located here reflecting on about my pain here. I feel like I'm here in this body reflecting on this particular part of my bodily experience.
Okay. Well, let me, I really don't want to keep people too long, but let me tell you what the specific thing I'd like to ask you to do, but maybe we can do it in a broader context, because people have raised a lot of important questions, I think. So the broader context, I'll give you that first, is just to investigate this question further. You know, we can have various theories about it right now, but over the course of the next day, and I'm probably going to try to return to this off and on. I don't want to take too much time during the conference, but just remind you. I certainly want to remind you, because you'll forget. You know. But maybe we can take a few minutes here and there to discuss this and see what are people finding in general about this question. What is the perspective from which you experience? That's the broader context. And if you start off doubting that there is a perspective, then look and see. But the specific question is if, and here I'm really going to assume for the moment that your typical perspective is that you tend to be located up in here, behind the eyes or in the forehead, in this general region. Try moving your perspective down more into the region of the chest. You might find it more natural to do it more from the belly. I don't care so much. I'm just looking for a change. Okay. So if you say, well, normally it seems like I experience from here, see what happens if you try to move down more into the chest. And a perfect example would be if you're involved in a conversation with somebody. Hey, you can't forget. But if you're involved in a conversation with somebody, ask yourself, well, what is my perspective here? And what happens if I shift it? So the basic shift that I'm asking for is from up here to down here.
Conversation's going to run dry, isn't it?
You think? Because people...
If you're concentrating on where you're currently positioned internally and then trying to shift it to another part, you're not going to be listening to your...
Well, we're surprisingly good at doing... Yeah, multitasking. And you especially, Stacey.
and a feminine movement.
If I may say so. Yeah, I think Russ will tell you that a lot of times people are doing a lot of other things during lectures. So why not moving their center of perspective down a few feet?
So that's the practice whenever you think of it. And I'm going to remind you.
Is it okay for me to just comment that maybe sometimes some people might find themselves moving in rather than moving down.
Yes.
Moving from the outside inside.
Yeah. I really want to leave this very open. If you try to make this move and you find that instead you move in, or perhaps you find that you're move out or up, that's interesting. I don't care too much what your experience is. Number one, I care about the shift.
What do you move away?
You just like move away, like yeah.
Oh, up there. Yeah. Looking down.
Okay. So number one, I'm interested in the shift. Just what is it like to try a shift? Mm. Specifically, I am interested in trying to make the move down into the body.
Mm. But if
you find it more interesting to go somewhere else, that's fine.
How far down do you want to go?
Well, I'm suggesting but again, some people may find it more interesting. You know, there are Buddhist traditions in which they talk about being centered more in the belly. Mm. Some people might find it natural or more interesting to go there.
I know quite a few people.
But you're basically interested in the location, to find where it is, so to say, physically placed.
Well, okay, I'm glad you asked that question. I actually am not so interested in the location. I'm interested in your experience. And I want to know what happens to your experience when you try to shift your location.
Just a clarification, Matthew. Mm-hmm. I find it quite easy to ask myself, what am I feeling down here?
Mm-hmm.
Down here.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But is that what you mean?
No, it's not. And I think you've been kind of honing in on that question, and I'm glad you are, at various times. One way to ask the question would be, if you ask, what am I feeling in the chest, where do you ask that from? Right? If you ask it from the chest, then you're doing what I'm asking you to do. But if you ask it down here, you know.
But it's not just that. You want us to be asking where the pain in our foot is being felt from. You want it to also be felt from the chest.
Everything.
Whereas I was saying, I feel the pain in my foot from the whole body, rather than that, not just one part of my body.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all okay for me to try and limit it to, I don't know what it would mean to only experience, be conscious of my experience, or think about my experience, or experience it from a perspective other than the place where it's actually located in my body.
I think you need to do a more preliminary inquiry, and I don't mean preliminary in the sense of less sophisticated at all, but you need to ask, what is the issue of perspectivalism all about? You know, do I have a perspective on my experience or not? And is that perspective different from the actual experiential quality? So for you, that's the preliminary question too. Right? So look at that. Okay. Anything else for this evening? No?
Would it be possible when we talk that somebody give
the
word?
Chairman, yes.
Be there be a chairman for the talk?
Sorry?
A chairman for the talk?
Yes.
So
somebody look at the people who want to talk and say you and you.
Oh, okay.
For me, it's very important because when everybody speaks together, I don't understand anything.
Mm-hmm.
And when I have something to do, to say, to ask, it's difficult for me to ask because
you just have to say, "Hey, Mac."
Everything is very more rapid than me.
Yes.
It's very difficult. Anyway, it's always difficult for me, but it's even more difficult because there is no chairman.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what you think about that, but I propose that.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's try to do something like that, and I think it's good for you to mention the point that you know, if people speak very quickly, Claire is going to have some difficulty with it. That's the more basic point. So let's try to keep that in mind. Okay. And let me just say that was anybody listening to Claire from the chest, trying to do that?
Yeah.
You forgot, right? Okay. It's okay.
I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
You have to look. You have to find out.
But it's a balance. You're balancing your consciousness between here and here. You cannot really move it away from that. Even using all the meditative techniques, I can't see you really moving it.
Mm-hmm.
Your belly, you're conscious of balancing it between these two points.
Mm-hmm. You know, maybe what you find is that there's a kind of a balance, and that there's a kind of a balance, and this is maybe closer to what Ron is talking about, a more global bodily perspective, let's call it. Maybe that's what you find.
The idea of shifting it all from here to here, to have all your consciousness focused.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I find that a rather impossible task.
Well, do you think if your consciousness is all focused, you say normally it's focused here, do you think it's all focused here?
I think most of the time, for me it is, through meditative techniques I can move more, I can use it to come through my body.
Yeah.
But it's an exercise to do that.
Okay, well, see what happens. And let me just say, since you brought up the M word, I don't think of this as a meditative technique. I mean, it is something that's related to what people do in meditative practice and certain kinds of meditative practice. But I'm just asking you to do it in the most casual way.
But as a practitioner of phenomenological research, I am a little bit bothered here because we are mixing two things. You know, one is for example, first part of what you said is one cannot do it or something, you know, just some, or my body is, I don't know, let's say, all the sum of all possible or something like that. This philosophical third person, you know, which is great, but it's one. And the other is phenomenological description of how it's to be, how it's like to be me right now, you know. So I don't know. It's your game, so please. But I'm. It's really annoying for me because I can't jump from one description to another. You know, if that is just an exercise, then let's try to bracket all the what is it. Just let's perhaps I don't understand. I don't understand exactly what you mean. And I think you jumped quickly from. Just experience, and then you already presuppose that we are feeling it here, and now we have to do something. So perhaps it would be nice to give us like 2 or 3 days just to realize where we are, and then say shift it.
That would be better, I think, actually. So, but we don't necessarily have time. Russ, you were going to say?
I was going to observe that we have entirely ignored Claire's suggestion.
I was trying to honor it just now, actually. But thank you. Let us really try to stay with the suggestion that we go one at a time, that the mechanism we use for that is to have a moderator. And right now, since it's my turn, I'm moderating. Max.
Yeah. Would it ruin your exercise in any way to give us a little bit of the background? Or you'd rather do it without... I mean, obviously you have a reason for doing it. I'm thinking if you explain a little bit.
No, I'd actually rather...
To do it a little bit.
Let me call on myself. I would rather we do it without any theoretical presuppositions, let's say. And to comment on what Urban said, I really am looking for the experiential mode. I really would prefer that people bracket their assumptions about what is possible or isn't possible. On the other hand, and this does go into my theoretical take on it, I think everybody starts from a theoretical mode, and only to a certain extent can we bracket it. But that's why... Okay, I am going to say something theoretical. Or no, it's more methodological. The method that interests me is to change our experience. You know? Not to observe our experience as we normally have it, which of course is very important and valuable, but to do something different. And this is an example of doing something different. And that is really the single most important thing about it. Now, yes, I've chosen this particular approach for reasons that I will get to when I give my presentation of this particular exercise. Yes, Michel?
Yes, I think in line with what Urban said, I think before we go through all these steps that you are indicating, we should, first of all, devise a method in order to point exactly from where everything is seen, felt, and so on and so on. So I propose to show you such a method.
That's fine.
And there is time. No theory, no words, just a few indications, a few elements of guidance. And then everybody will discover, without even thinking, where it is seen from, where everything is seen from, felt from.
Would you like to do that right now? Are people open to that?
A little bit.
A little too much?
Late, because I think it takes time.
Okay.
The very important point is that it takes at least 20 minutes.
Okay. So maybe we've been talking about the... all this wonderful extra time we have tomorrow, which I can see disappearing. But maybe that would be a good time to introduce it. So that's fine. I'm grateful. And I'd be very happy to have you do that. Okay? Good night.
So what is our upcoming schedule?
Ah, breakfast is at, does somebody have the schedule?
7:30 to 8:30.
Breakfast is buffet style.
Geneva.
Start
7:30.
Okay. The first session is at 9:15.
So the first session. So we meet here at 9:15 tomorrow, and our tasks for tomorrow include Tom giving us an orientation to the inactive torch, and maybe at some point during the day we find time, Michelle, for you to do your little practice.
No, it's not mine actually. It's one of my Italian friends.
Okay. And our other task is the one that I've assigned you, which is to see what happens if you shift your focus. And I don't think you need to postpone that practice, pending what Michelle is going to show us. Just try it. See what happens, even if you're not very clear.